You're listening to Free City Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. I'm Stefan Christophe, and this is our weekly radio broadcast on CKUT. On the program today, we are going to be hearing from filmmaker Ariel Nasser, who made a really important documentary film called The Forbidden Reel that documents the lives and experiences of Afghan filmmakers, particularly who are working to sustain film archives in the context of the Taliban rule in Afghanistan in the 1990s. But also it really gives a portrait as to Afghan filmmakers and archivists and the cultural sector in Kabul. The film is a work that Ariel released before the recent crisis in Afghanistan. And I'd heard that Ariel and others have been working on an initiative to support Afghan filmmakers in this time in November 2021. And I thought it would be a really important moment to hear Ariel's reflections about the current crisis in Afghanistan and offer some insights and critical perspectives as to where we are at today, and also the responsibility of people within countries of NATO, which occupied Afghanistan for so many years. We look at the contemporary situation from many different angles, and I recorded this conversation in the Crepuscule Sculpture Park here in Montreal, just off of Van Horn Street. So here's my conversation with filmmaker Ariel Nasser. With filmmaker Ariel Nasser, who worked on a very important film called The Forbidden Reel that has shown recently in Montreal at Cinéma du Parc, but was shown internationally at many festivals. We've been talking recently about the crisis in Afghanistan and about the lack of context in terms of understanding this moment, which has so many angles, so many aspects. But, you know, maybe one thing that in terms of reaching out to you, Ariel, I was thinking about was just sort of the lack of context that we hear in the media around, like, the role of intervention and how that reshaped the political, economic, social, cultural map of Afghanistan. I know you spent a lot of time there. You have family there. One thing that maybe is not in the headlines right now that had a huge impact was the U.S. surge of forces under Obama, 2010 till 12, I believe. And I bring that up just to think about the amount of resources, like material, financial resources, but also material resources, human resources that went into the intervention, military intervention, and how that changed, you know, within the last 2 years in terms of moving towards a quote unquote peace process with the Taliban. I'm just wondering if you could offer any reflections, given that you were in those spaces of contradiction, about the fact that there was space created, you know, within the context of intervention, and many Afghan people took that space, and filmmakers and feminist organizations and took action to reconstitute and to
to reassert presence in Afghanistan. And on the Western Front, there was like so much money and so much time. And it seems like so much of that today, it amounted to posturing, which I think maybe people think about billions of dollars. It's sort of trillions. It's sort of mind-blowing to think about.
Yeah, it is. It does feel like a turning point. Like, it feels like a very big turning point, obviously, with the Taliban coming back into power. The whole mission over 20 years, more than two decades, was framed around human rights and around, positioning the Taliban as not only being having a deplorable human rights record, but more specifically having a deplorable record on women's rights. And I think it was a little bit awkward for the U.S. to start the peace process and to move through that with an enemy that had been portrayed as absolute evil. And the result of that, I mean, I think there were a few, helped to justify the war to the public in a time when Islamophobia was at its peak. So that's something I think should be acknowledged, and that was used, and Islamophobia being a form of racism. So, you know, this is something that I think you should spot whenever you can. But I mean, racism is definitely present anytime we're justifying wars in countries that are far away, that where the populations are people that we've racialized. And so I think that's a really big element of it. But when it ceases to be convenient for these outside forces, these larger countries and richer countries, then of course that's where you see the holes in the rhetoric, right? Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden peace is the ultimate good, right? All of a sudden it's peace that's the ultimate good and not human rights that we have to fight for, right? That we have to disrupt the peace. There was peace before that, you know. Mm-hmm. Say what you will about the regime, the country was not in a state of war, which it had been previous to that, which was, for the most part, why Afghans had accepted the Taliban. It was because they brought a certain level of, they brought a certain level of calm in terms of out and out conflict. Of course, for the women of Afghanistan, for Afghan women, you know, throughout the country, life got harder. Although one could argue that for subsistence farmers, life didn't necessarily change very much. But I think it's really, to me, shocking how the rhetoric changes around the war, without a whole lot of accountability for what was said before, without taking stock of like what was said before and what makes sense, or okay, if we were wrong before, are there lessons to be learned from that, right? So let's learn those hard lessons, let's have some reckoning. And but it doesn't happen. So I think to some extent, you know, there's a certain value for governments in allowing the public to only have a short memory of what's been happening, because it means that they don't have to be accountable. They don't have to explain their mistakes. They don't have to learn their lessons. And the damage is not to the politicians if they're getting reelected. I mean, the damage is to the taxpayers. The damage is to the human beings who live in the places where the wars are taking place, to people who fight. So, So I think it's really sad, I think efforts. You know, we need to make greater efforts to keep people accountable, and I think journalists should be doing that as well. So, and that's where I feel like journalism really failed in Afghanistan, because although there were some really great journalists who made sacrifices and worked very hard to tell important stories about Afghanistan, unfortunately their voices are drowned out by a majority of journalism about Afghanistan that just isn't factual, that's misleading, and that was very lazy, actually, in terms of the practice of journalism. you know, a lack of deeper research, relying on too few sources, naming sources in articles that couldn't be tracked down. You know, the famous Abdul who only has one name, you know. There are many ways of identifying people, right? You can say where they're from. You could say where their father is, for example, as is done in Afghanistan. So a lot of the journalism was very lazy and intended to simply reinforce what governments were saying about Afghanistan and just play into that narrative. And rather than bringing fresh information, you know, new information or really investigating more deeply. Unfortunately, I think that created confusion on the part of the general public in countries, in NATO countries, you know, in countries that were invested in fighting in Afghanistan and made it harder for the public to really make informed decisions when they were voting or when they were expressing their opinion about the war. So that, I think, was a big failure, you know. And, you know, you can criticize governments, but you kind of expect to a certain extent that when a government is involved in a war, they are going to shape the narrative aggressively, you know, for their own purposes. But that's what journalists should be there to stop. And I was extremely demoralized to see that that wasn't happening for the most part. Journalism was there to support the narratives that were created by governments. That's what they were there for. That's how they framed the debate. The debate was framed by the states, you know, that were involved in the wars. And outside of that, you had very little high level, well informed debate. So although, you know, there were definitely a lot of people on the left who felt that, you know, the war was unjustified. You know, unfortunately, without good journalism, it's very hard to make arguments that really hold weight. And so, again, without that information that journalists can provide, you know, we're kind of lost. And so much of it was just sensational, or it was focused obsessively on the concerns of audiences back home rather than alerting them to things that they should be concerned about. I mean, one example of that was the prisoner transfer scandal, which I thought was a lot of ink was shed. A lot of ink was shed on something that was fairly inconsequential when you think about Canada's most important ally in the war and what was happening in their prisons, right? But nobody was debating whether we should be allied with a power, an ally that tortured people in prison.
Well, I think maybe people might not remember what that was, unfortunately. Yeah, I mean, the prisoner transfer scandal, as it was called, I mean, it was so important in the headlines in Canada at a moment. But it shows also the ways that it seems like there isn't an actual commitment to follow through politically in terms of, like, these expressed sort of gestures towards human rights or towards, you know, prisoner rights or...
That's right. I mean, for me, like, one of the things that I would have liked to have seen discussed in the media at that time was how is the Canadian military and the U.S. military, their allies, and the British military, how are they making their decisions about who to strike in Kandahar, in those places where they're fighting, in Helmand, right, in those southern places where there was a heavy Taliban presence? How are they making their decisions around who to fight, right? Because there's no front line. You know, this is not conventional, traditional warfare. So how are they making their decisions about who to surveil and who to fight and who to... So that's what I would have liked to know about. And that's, I think, what the public deserved to know about, because we were killing people over there, right? And we were killing people at times, I believe, for their opinions rather than for their actions. So when you're bringing democracy somewhere and you're killing people because of their political opinions, you're not bringing democracy, right? So this is problematic, and I think the public should have known about that. You know, I think they should have had more insight into exactly what was happening in with decision makers in the military and when they were making decisions around who to fight, who to kill. That was the legacy that we left behind, and we know very little about it, actually. You know, the fact that some Taliban prisoners were beat up in Afghan prisons, you know, to have that create the debate that it did over here, and the political, you know, maelstrom that it created over here, it just speaks to really deep naivete, because there were so many other areas that we could look where we would have found abuses that were worse than that. That's what I mean by, I feel like, unfortunately, somehow journalism failed in that war as a whole. Not that there weren't good journalists, but that overall, we received a very, very distorted picture of what was happening there. And so, quite incredibly, after, you know, those 20 years of war, most people still know very, very little about Afghanistan. They have a handful of sensational stereotypes, and that's about it. And so I think it's problematic. On the flip side, I think Canadians, you know, and I'm sure this is true about other NATO countries too, want to know more. I think that they want to know more. I think they want to be involved. I think they want to help people. And I've seen that, like, since the this new chapter, you know, since August 15th, when the Afghan government changed. I've seen that. I mean, I've heard from so many Canadians who know that I'm involved in some efforts to help Afghan people, Afghan filmmakers get out of Afghanistan, who know that who've heard me speak about Afghanistan. I receive messages all the time asking how people can help, right? And so I know that there's goodwill, you know. I think that if people had better information that you know, that we'd be making better decisions as a country. So it's just so important. But yeah, it's been a major, major chapter. And I think for anyone who has connections in Afghanistan, to Afghanistan, who has family there or some link to the country, it's been a really devastating time. I mean, it's you have people who've invested decades of their lives into a context and a situation that was challenging, but provided a certain set of opportunities and promises, and now that has just disappeared overnight. And so it's created a lot of it's really created a great deal of desperation. And I do feel that, you know, Western governments perhaps could have done more to help you know, at the end. And maybe can continue to do more, and putting the well-being of ordinary Afghans first, I think, is what needs to happen in every decision. You know, to play politics at this point around aid is really shameful after everything that's happened. We're not an alliance that has made great decisions the whole way through this war, you know? This is not a situation where, you know, one side can stand taller than the other and render judgments. So what we need to do is recognize that we were involved in a failed attempt to change Afghanistan, and that at the very least now, that things have turned out badly despite our efforts, that we can put ordinary Afghans ahead of the politics that brought us to this point. So that's what I think needs to happen, you know? There needs to be pressure from the Canadian public and from publics across the West to put Afghans first, to put Afghan people, their well-being, their health, their safety, their food on their tables, that has to come before any politics. And frankly, the NATO alliance went to Afghanistan, and the US went to Afghanistan in force to change a government and change a country's ideology. And the Taliban have done the same thing. So really, morally speaking, there's no reason now to act as though the Taliban stole something, you know? What right did the U.S. have to go to Afghanistan in the first place? Only the right of conquest, only the right of we were stronger and we have, you know, we've changed things because we could, and because strategically they're better for us this way. And, you know, now a different set of forces has done the same thing and moved the country in another direction. And it's not where we wanted to see it go. And there will be a lot of negative consequences for women, for children, for people across the country, for minorities, for religious minorities. There'll be a lot of negative repercussions for them. You know, but at the end of the day, we don't have a moral high ground to judge the Taliban for having taken the government by force. So, you know, I mean, I really think it's time to put politics aside as far as Afghanistan goes and just help and just try to help ordinary people get through what's going to be an incredibly difficult time economically. So if anything, you know, aid should be increased to provide people with what they need to survive what's going to be a terrible time. And the politics can really, I think, take a back seat at this point. But I don't see that happening, and I feel a lot of despair because it appears as though even after we should have learned, right, that bringing our politics to another foreign country far away, you know, needs to be done with an attitude of, you know, first do no harm, you know, not with the kind of profligate, you know, spending and use of military that resulted in this huge, like, I would say, increase in the threat of the Taliban in like really pouring gasoline onto a fire. I mean, you have a place that's been struggling with conflict for decades, bringing more weapons to that country, I would say, mm-hmm. like just as a basic principle is probably not a good idea. There might be other ways you can work with that country diplomatically to try and improve things, right? There are other tools. And I think, I just think it's really sad that having failed in our efforts to control Afghanistan militarily, we're now trying to control outcomes by withholding aid, which is desperately needed by ordinary people. So it's very sad. But you know, the more time you spend in Afghanistan, the less you can say for certain, right? The less willing you are, I think, to make sort of big statements about politics and ideology. It's a very complex place, but it's also a place where personal relationships are incredibly important. Mm. I think when there's disruption, a lot of that gets disrupted. You know, I think that's.
Your work places Afghans agency at the center. So when we're like looking at this time in the next months, when there's going to be a lot of sort of very well-intentioned stories about victims or people struggling, which is not to say that's not a reality. I'm just wondering if you could talk about the importance of sort of, you know, that decision you made to show the agency of Afghan filmmakers, but also just in terms of like thinking critically about how to approach this moment when people sort of think about trying to step up in various ways.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's face it, there's not a whole lot we can do to help people who are in Afghanistan other than give them reassurances and visa letters that they can't use because there's no way for them to leave the country, right? So without their agency in this situation, you know, there's very little hope for them. So people are having to leave Afghanistan. So people are having to leave Afghanistan, and that in itself is a really challenging thing to do right now, and then others are remaining in Afghanistan and even protesting, you know, what the measures that the new government has brought in. So, you know, the Afghan people, you know, are struggling to make their situation better all the time, right? I mean, that you can take for granted, but. In this particular situation, I think there's a lot of sense of helplessness on both sides. You know, I think that the help that has been provided by some countries has been important, but I really think that it could have gone further and could go further. So hopefully, you know, there will be a sustained effort to continue to help people who need to leave the country because of their involvement in, not just in the military or diplomatic sectors of, sure, you know, the effort. I mean, there was also this massive effort on paper, like concerted effort, to create alternatives to the types of media that the Taliban were promulgating in Afghanistan. So you had huge amounts of money spent on creating different forms of media. And then you had this burgeoning television sector in Afghanistan where you had like 13 unique television stations all in Kabul, and then across the country many more. And so, you know, this was also a concerted effort on the part of the Western alliance in Afghanistan, was to foster a civil society that could act as an alternative and attract, yeah, yeah, you know, people away from Taliban ideology and towards. And it was a very clear, stated, documented message. So then there is responsibility on the part of the West when it comes to people who decided to invest in that vision and become artists, become filmmakers, become different forms of cultural leaders, yeah, in Afghanistan. And I think there's still a responsibility to those, yeah, people as well to provide whatever aid we can, mm-hmm, that, you know, to the extent that will be helpful. There's only so much we can do, and that can be recognized. But also just dealing compassionately with Afghanistan through its new government in order to make sure that we're not causing more suffering than is necessary, I think is like the chief thing that we could do, you know?
That was a conversation with filmmaker Ariel Nasser, who worked on a really great film called The Forbidden Reel. I'd encourage people to check it out. And more generally, Ariel's work, he also made a really moving short documentary about Sudanese-Canadian Abu Sufyan Abdulrazik, who was exiled and struggled to return to Canada as a citizen of Canada, and faced many, many obstacles and barriers within that process after he was tortured and jailed in Sudan within a context that Canada had direct responsibility in regards to the Security and Intelligence Service of Canada, CSIS. So also look up Ariel's work in that regard and his many other projects. Thank you, Ariel, again for joining the program today. This has been Free City Radio on CKUT. I'm your host, Stefan Christoph. We broadcast a new episode every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Thanks for tuning in today, and we'll be back next week. Do stay tuned for the F-Files, which is coming up next. We share a radio hour here on CKUT. Free City Radio is also a podcast. You can find the archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. Also, you can look up our program on Apple Podcasts and subscribe there. Thanks again for listening. I want to finish the program today with a recent piece of music that my brother, Jordan Christoph, worked on. It is from an album that is released this year called Wombs. I'll talk to you next week. Take care.
Okay, super. How are you today?
I'm very well.
Excellent.